This week on the Backtable Podcast.
A big part of the learning with any startup is, how do you get capital? What are the terms that that comes with that you can work with to make sure that you're setting up for the future of the company? And what are the different stages? And that was a big part of the learning for me is that, well, I could present on the technology and how it's needed, but things like understanding the market and the market, you know, the first thing you think about is, okay, well, what's the market size and how many patients are there? How much does a stent cost, a stent procedure? And understanding that is very, very, very important.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. Now, a brief message from our sponsor.
Greetings to our esteemed IR community. Picture a future where cutting-edge interventional technologies are seamlessly integrated with world-class imaging tools that are designed to reshape procedural efficiency, enhance precision, and foster patient-centered care in interventional radiology. Because that's our vision at Varian, and we're working with partners across Siemens Healthineers to bring it to life. What sets our Imbazine and Oncozine microspheres apart? Features that enhance procedural and cost efficiency, like precise calibration and syringes that contain more microspheres per volume, which means fewer syringes per procedure. And Imbazine microspheres offer a broad spectrum of 10 sizes, each identified by distinctive colors, facilitating visualization of suspension. This streamlines the process and also minimizes the potential for errors. So experience the future of interventional radiology with Varian. Check out our innovative solutions at varian.com/interventional. Varian, a Siemens Healthineers company, we pioneer breakthroughs in healthcare for everyone, everywhere, sustainably.
This episode is supported by Reflow Medical, makers of high-performance medical devices for peripheral and coronary interventions. Reflow credits much of the company's rapid growth to their physician partners, who spurred the development of successful products like the Wingman Crossing Catheter, the Specs and the Specs LP Shapeable Support Catheters, and the Cora Catheter Suite. Solutions that are physician-imagined and Reflow-engineered. For more information, visit reflowmedical.com. And now, back to the show.
Today, we got a great episode that is probably going to go out on both the Innovation and Vascular Interventional show. We're going to be telling the origin story of Oxetix. Did I pronounce that correctly, Ramsey?
That's correct, Oxetix.
Oxetix. So Oxetix is a medtech company with a new venous stent. It's founded by Dr. Ramsey Al-Hakim. Ramsey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. Look forward to sharing our story here.
Yeah. So Ramsey, the way I like to start out is to tell the audience a little bit about your background, where you're at, and what your practice looks like.
Yeah, so currently I'm at Scripps Health, sort of a hybrid private practice academic. Scripps has a long history of innovation and research. I am specifically at Scripps Green Hospital doing full-time interventional radiology. And yeah, that's pretty much where I'm at now. And then obviously, when I'm not practicing, I am leading Oxetix.
And I definitely want to jump into that, like how you balance that with your practice, because that's always interesting to me. But growing up, especially on the Innovation Show, what I like to ask physician founders a lot is like, did you have any entrepreneurial or self-starter tendencies? Like, did you know you started a candy store in middle school or something, anything like that, that really helped drive you towards being more of an entrepreneur?
You know, I would say as a kid growing up, I was more interested in problem solving than entrepreneurship. Is if I see a problem, I just got to understand it. You know, as I have to figure out, well, okay, well, what's going on here? What's the underlying issue before trying to come up with a solution? And that's kind of always the way I've been. There were so many toys that I took apart growing up, and most of them never made it back together. But it was just my trying to understand how things work, I think, is more of how my mind works. And that's kind of why I went into engineering initially, studied biomedical engineering at Georgia Tech, is, you know, a strong interest in physics and math and trying to figure out how things work.
And so let's get into the story of, you know, where you were in your career when the original idea for the stent came about. Can you kind of tell us that story?
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in Georgia. After engineering, I decided to go into medicine with ultimately the plan that I thought I would probably do research and some sort of hybrid between engineering and medicine. Went out to med school at UCLA, did residency there. And then I went to Miami Vascular for fellowship. So obviously I was really interested in vascular. The emphasis was mostly arterial. At that time, I graduated 2017, obviously aorta, PAD, was a strong vascular interest at that time. First job was at OHSU in Portland, Oregon, and I started working with John Kaufman, and he was obviously had a long history of deep venous interventions, and I started doing more venous interventions with him. And I was learning, and I was really fascinated by the venous interventions, and I realized that I kind of had a gap in knowledge, or what I thought was a gap in knowledge. So I said, okay, well, I'm just going to go and, you know, kind of read everything I can about veins. And it turns out that only takes about a week. There's not a lot out there.
Right.
That, you know, I was pulling up papers from the 60s just to try to understand the basic biomechanics. And that was one of the things that got me realizing that, wow, veins are just a deep blue ocean. There's a big knowledge gap. Everything you can possibly dream about and more has been studied with arteries in terms of biomechanics and devices, but with veins, there was a big gap. And I saw that, you know, multiple venous stents were coming on the market, so it was a little bit interesting to me that there was that gap. And, you know, the origin was very simple. Is I was doing some cases with Kaufman. I put a venous stent in, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there was a narrowing in the vein that I didn't touch. And I was perplexed. You know, I was, well, what happened here? I didn't touch that vein. Why did the inflow all of a sudden become narrowed? And I saw it again. And, you know, I asked Kaufman, and he said, you know, well, we kind of see that. We think maybe it's spasm, but it doesn't really respond to nitro. And again, going back to the biomechanics, spasm doesn't make sense because veins don't have a thick, smooth muscle wall. So I asked around a lot of people. I went back to the literature again, see if I could find anything. And ultimately, it came down to, well, there must be one of two things. It must be a Bernoulli effect or a Poisson effect. Bernoulli is, you know, when you have a pressure change, you have a low pressure, and you might be creating a sort of a suction. And Poisson effect is, it's a very, very simple biomechanical phenomenon that was described over 200 years ago by a French mathematician, which is basically if you take a rubber band and you pull it in one direction, what happens in the other direction? It narrows. And pretty much most materials, and specifically almost all tissue, has this property to some degree. So we did a lot of testing, benchtop testing, and we found out it was the Poisson effect, was that whenever you apply radial outward force with these stents, you end up pulling the adjacent vein. And that was where it all began, was this new understanding that, hey, this is something that has not been explored. Radial force has been the only force applied by stents since the original first stent, you know, 30 years ago. And maybe it's time we need to start rethinking that. And that's kind of how it was all started.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What was the clinical manifestations when you saw it narrowing? Because you were treating the patients with the stent, you saw the narrowing. What was happening? You were sending them home and they were rethrombosing. Can you tell us, like, what was the result of that narrowing for the uninitiated audience?
Yeah, it's a good question. Is you see it, and what do? Some people extend the stent, and the problem with extending the stent is you may just translocate that narrowing down further. So you end up sort of chasing the stenosis. So one of the things that we definitely see is when you create the inflow narrowing, which is called SAS, stent-adjacent stenosis. So when you create this SAS and this inflow narrowing, you create a mismatch between the inflow diameter and the stented diameter. And the reason that's important is that alters your flow mechanics, particularly the shear rate, or, you know, and what people refer to as eddy currents, is you get these areas of circulating blood. And the way that that manifests in the procedure room is you do your injection and you see that there's not great washout through the stent, is that you see that layering contrast and everybody kind of knows it and everybody gets a little, ooh, you don't like it, and you're kind of imagining blood sitting there and platelets aggregating and red blood cells adhesing, and you're thinking, oh, I hope this doesn't either A, result in long-term stenosis, which there's now studies showing that those flow characteristics are linked to that, specifically a study of Dr. Raju's over 500 patients looking at shear rate, and that is the strongest prediction of in-stent stenosis and need for reintervention. So yeah, there is a strong clinical link to that stent-adjacent stenosis and the flow disturbances that it causes and how it affects our patients. So it is very important.
Well, thank you for explaining that. Yeah, that is the key thing, I think, is like, what do you do with it? And then what were your next steps? Because you probably knew, okay, extending the stent's not going to help. Ballooning, it's not going to help. Before you found the solution, what were you doing in those cases? What were you doing for those patients?
Watching closely and crossing our fingers. So basically sort of using the standard criteria, which are somewhat subjective. So, you know, you could measure with the IVUS the inflow, see if you have more than 50% or so cross-sectional area reduction. But again, this was before when we had a little bit less data, and really subjectively off the flow, you know, how much layering contrast and sort of deciding subjectively if you need to extend. And then if you extend, the real important thing is not to oversize too much and really be careful with that extension. And the reason is that the more you oversize, the more Poisson effect you get. Now, that being said, if you size properly, you will still get Poisson effect and stent-adjacent stenosis. But if you oversize, you'll get more. And this was a time, you know, when these first stents are coming out, that there was a lot of learning, because with the wall stents, we all learn that you markedly oversize because you're going to get recoil. And that recoil is actually due to the Poisson effect. You know, is you take a 20 millimeter wall stent, you balloon it to 20, we all know it's going to come back down to 14. If you pay attention, it's actually foreshortening as it does that. And that is partially the wall stent that is natural mechanics and partially the Poisson effect. So, you know, the answer was you do the best that you can, try to get the best flow you can, extend a lot of the times, and then watch the patient very closely.
So you identified the problem that you wanted to solve, and you, with your engineering mind, it was like, okay, I can fix this. What were your next steps?
So initially, there was a lot of benchtop work trying to really understand this. And, you know, I was making a lot of trips to Home Depot, actually, and I was building a ex vivo box to look at this effect a little bit more closely. We built a little, you know, ex vivo system so we could directly visualize it, because we were still trying to really understand it, even though we kind of did. We didn't really understand the details. And one of the big questions that we had to answer before we move forward to really convince ourselves we understood this is, why does this happen in veins and not arteries? And even though we knew it was the Poisson effect, we couldn't really answer that question. And we all sort of felt, well, if we can't answer this, then we don't really understand it enough. So we're building these boxes, we're using, you know, animal arteries and veins, and we're directly visualizing it. And finally, we realize, and this is where some of these papers from the 60s come in, is that the difference that's very critical is that arteries are highly elastic and veins are not. Veins are actually relatively stiff when you look at the tissue itself. And, you know, a lot of people were saying, oh, veins are highly elastic, this is why we have to make high radial force stents. And the reason that there was a lot of this misnomer is because of that recoil that happens when you put a stent in and it comes down. But again, that's all because of the Poisson effect. When you're applying a radial force, it's getting redistributed to the longitudinal and you're losing control. And the other thing is that veins, people sort of think naturally looking at them that they must be highly elastic, because when you're dehydrated, they're completely flat.
They're collapsing.
Exactly. When you get hydrated, they go to this full, but that's a change in geometry. And that actually does not stress the vein wall. And so you're not really applying any stress. It's just a change in geometry. So when you actually apply a high rate of stress, what you see is that veins don't stretch and arteries do. And why is this important? Because arteries, when you apply radial force, you do get a Poisson effect in a longitudinal, but the artery is able to compensate by stretching, and the veins are not. And so when you pull on this tough tissue, you get this geometric distortion in the SAS. So that was a big moment. Once we understood it, we said, okay, we get it. It's the Poisson effect, and it's strongly related to the elasticity and Young's modulus and stiffness of the vein wall. So naturally, we then realized that this is going to be a lot worse in patients that have post-thrombotic syndrome and the veins walls are really stiff. So then once we understood it, that's when I just went home on a Friday after talking with the team about this and understanding it. Over the weekend, it kind of hit me. I was like, well, we should just make a stent that can counteract this, that can elongate, that can apply a longitudinal force. Why are we only putting force in one direction and radial outwards? You know, the vein wall is a two-dimensional structure, but we're only putting one-dimensional force. It doesn't make sense. So I started, you know, like any good scientist, Googling and figuring out, you know. Yeah, exactly. Started consulting Dr. Google and co-scientist Dr. Google. And what I started to realize is anisotropic force application is really what we want. And then I started figuring out this term auxitic. So auxitic is an engineering term. It's not new. It's been around for a while, that describes a material that has a negative Poisson ratio. And so what that means is, like I was describing the rubber band, when you pull it in one direction, it narrows in the other. There are actually materials, when you pull it in one direction, instead of narrowing, it does expand. And that's called auxitic. And there's actually decades of geometric research into auxitic geometries and how they function. So I sort of said, okay, well, I was very naive at the time. And I was like, okay, obvious, great. We just use this and we make a stent. There's no problem. Obviously, that was very naive. And making stents and designing stents, it's a very complex process. But I got really lucky reaching through Dr. Kaufman's network. We sort of talked to one person who led to a chain to another. And ultimately, we met Craig Bonsignor. If you don't know Craig, Craig's been involved with stents since, you know, the original stents. And most stents that you've heard of, he's probably been involved in one way or another. And he is kind of the guy. And so I met with him and I explained my idea. I said, hey, I just want to make a stent that elongates, it can stretch it in two directions. Can you do that? And he said, it's a really intriguing idea. And I don't know, because nobody's ever asked me. And I said, okay, well, let's figure it out together. And there's a Roche fund, a Roche Innovation Fund at OHSU, exactly for things like this. And so that's how we started. I applied for that. And we used that funding to have Craig come out to Portland as a consultant. You know, when Craig came out, I remember Barry Yoshida was there. And any idea you're working with in the daughter lab, Barry Yoshida, he's going to see it and he's going to be involved and he's going to have an opinion. And every idea I had up until then, you know, I would go to Barry, I have this idea. This is going to be great. And Barry would just do his jolly laugh and he would say, Ramsey, you know, we thought of that and here's what happened. And he would explain to you why it doesn't work. And then you'd go home with your tail between your legs. Okay. And so this was when I knew we had something. When I came to Barry, I said, Barry, look, we're going to make the stent that elongates. And because it, and he goes, huh? Yeah, we never thought of that. And that's what I realized between that and Craig. I realized this might be something.
That was my next question. I mean, in addition to Craig and, you know, running stuff by people at the daughter, you keep mentioning we, but what did your team look like? Did you have like a bunch of residents working under you, med students, engineers? What did your team look like at this sort of early stage?
At the early stage, it was me, Kashar Farsad, and John Kaufman, which later would become the three co-founders of auxitic. There was a resident at the time, Peter Lee, who was working with me, and we used to have what we call stent loading parties, where we would have to load the stent with liquid nitrogen, and we were so inexperienced at it and doing it completely manually, it would take about 1 to 2 hours per stent, which now, fortunately, only takes about 20 seconds, but at the time. And, you know, at the lab there, everybody's involved, right? People are coming in and out, and at this time, it was not auxitic and the IP and everything. It was just us exploring. But those were the main people involved from the very beginning. And so Craig came out, and through, you know, a small grant that we had with the Roche Fund, we sat around for 2 days and we just sort of spitball ideas for making stents of the different geometries. And we made sure that we're all on the same page of the biomechanics. Then he went and he came back with a prototype that he laser cut and it looked great. And he gave it to me and said, I don't know if you can crimp it or not. Because the thing about making stents is you start off with a really small hypo tube. Imagine like a really small straw, and you laser cut it from that. And then you have to manually expand it to the shape that you want it to be. And that's its nominal shape that it has memory for. Now you can cut anything and expand anything that you want, but can you crimp it back down into a delivery system is always the question.
And is this night null still?
Yeah, night null. Yeah, okay. It's all okay. Night null, laser cut. And that's really Craig's specialty. And we wanted to keep it night null. So that's where Peter Lee and I, we're, you know, in the lab with liquid nitrogen and trying not to freeze our fingers off and get this thing into a 18 French delivery system, which you can imagine should be easy, but where you're still struggling with that. And we were able to get it in. And so we deployed it on the benchtop, and we used sort of our benchtop testing system that we had developed. And we thought, it seems like it's working. It seems like it's doing what we want. And then we thought, well, we won't really know until we do animal testing. And so we did some non-survival animal testing. We actually created a stenosis using a technique that we published with RF ablation probes. We put the stent in, we ballooned it, and we kind of all looked at each other, and it was very perplexing because we had never seen a stent react this way. We had never seen a vein wall react this way, and it was all very novel and kind of confusing to us. And then we sat down, we talked about it, and we were like, well, it's confusing because it's doing exactly what we want it to do. And you don't have this Poisson effect, and you're able to expand, not have recoil, and not affect your adjacent stent. And the big moment was me, Kashyar, and John Kaufman were sitting around talking to Craig, sort of downloading after the animal study before Craig went back to the Bay Area. And we said, Craig, what do we have here? What should we do? And I'll never forget, his exact words were, push hard. And we thought, okay, I guess we have something. So we explored for a little bit, and I started to talk with the tech transfer office, disclose the technology. We were, you know, filing IP, and ultimately we decided the best way to get this technology into patients and to commercialize it was to create a startup. And so the three of us in summer of 2019, me, Kashyar Vasan, John Kaufman, we started the company and we said, we're going to take this commercially. That's where it was born.
That's incredible. And we've had different physician founders come on and talk about successful partnership, I would say, with an academic institution, and maybe not so. Like, for example, I don't know if you listened to Paul Maz's story with UT San Antonio, but it didn't go that way. Like, it wasn't as easy as just like, oh, let's work on this together. Did you have any challenges, you know, with that, or was that pretty smooth? I mean, for example, Oz Ahmed came on not too long ago to talk about how great it's been working with the University of Chicago on Flow Medical. You know, and so it seems like a lot of these medical institutions have kind of figured that out. Like, they want to support the innovators at their institution. Any challenges or anything like that? I mean, the daughter has a history of that, right?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when all of this started, you know, back to your original question about my entrepreneur tendencies, well, this is where I had to kind of figure it out, right? And I was sort of taking the lead and getting the technology out of the university. And I think with any university, it can be a challenging process, mainly because as a founder, I think you have to understand what you're kind of getting into and what the technology leaving the university means. So obviously Stanford and the biodesign and what they do there is kind of the gold standard, what a lot of universities are trying to replicate. And like you said, now they are, which their model is low threshold to let founders have a licensing agreement so they can go and push their technology without the university really holding back. Because if the university is really sort of making it difficult and, you know, trying to get a large share, then really nobody wins, right?
Delaying things.
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
so,
exactly.
So the model should be low threshold. And I think OHSU did a good job of that. But what I will say is that as a founder, it's important that you understand the whole process, whether the university has that kind of setup or not. So one of the things I hear a lot is young faculty basically saying, well, you know, innovation, the university is going to keep it all, right? And so do I really want to? And I sort of say, okay, well, you know, you got to understand what that means. And a lot of universities, yes, when you sign on, you sign with your employee agreement an IP portion, which basically says that if you have any technology that gets licensed from the university to a company, then here is what the earnings, how they're distributed. And it's a lot of the time something in the ballpark of 1/3 to the university, 1/3 to the department, and 1/3 to the founders. And so people look at that and say, well, you know, the university is going to take 2/3. But you have to understand that if you're taking a technology straight from the university to a company, a lot of the work for commercializing that is going to be done by the company. And although as a founder, you know, you've done a lot of the scientific work, there's still a lot of work to be done. And that's why it's kind of set up that way. So while on the surface, it might not seem fair, it's kind of the reason it's set up like that. And the second part to understand is that most, if not all universities have the option where instead of doing that, you can become a company and you can license the technology to your company. And that's what sort of the whole model of startup is. And if you do that, then the licensing agreement is completely different, right? And it's completely negotiated, and it's nothing like the standard agreement. For Auxitics, for example, that's what we do, is we create a company, Auxitics. We say we want the exclusive license agreement to this technology, which we developed in the university, and let's develop a licensing agreement for that. And that's really the big step to getting the technology out of the university, is negotiating that licensing agreement. And so it's not overly challenging once you understand that and you understand the incentives of the university and you understand what the portions of that licensing agreement are and how it's going to affect your company in the future. So where you need to make sure that you have rights and good terms and what's important, what's not as important. So I would say overall, it was a big learning process for me. OHSU, I think overall, was very supportive and they're very motivated for technology to move forward. I would say the hard part was not the university, it was me learning and figuring out what all of these terms are, what it means, and how to get through the process. So a lot of times when people ask me about this, that's what I end up talking to them mostly about, is don't be discouraged. Work with your tech transfer office. Their whole job is to get the technology out. And, you know, while it may be slow and it may feel like there's a lot to discuss, is ultimately this is all designed to help you long-term as a company. And so really kind of focus on that and try to lean on people who have gone through the process so that you understand it.
Right. Which brings me to, I wanted to bring up this name. I saw it on your website. Was when did Mahmoud Razavi come in? And I imagine he was... played a big role in that sort of advisory, since he's kind of the device guru. But when did he kind of play a part?
Yeah, Mahmoud actually came in just within the past year. We were really fortunate to have him. We went to him to have him join the team once we had the technology more developed. And once we felt like, okay, this is something that we can really push to get commercialized, and we really want to start getting the community at large, the venous stenting community at large, to understand what we're doing. So we approached him last year. I showed him what we were doing, and he was very excited. You know, he said, what you're doing makes sense, and you're the only one that I know of out there that's really taking a novel approach that's not just, you know, radial force. And so he joined us, and he's been very instrumental in helping us move forward. And you know, his ability to look at the market as a whole and understand where each technology fits in is uncanny. I mean, it's remarkable, and he's been a fantastic add and just a pleasure to work with, honestly.
Yeah, I imagine. And then, you know, there's your list of clinical and engineering advisors is also kind of a who's who in, you know, Venus IR world, you know, with Kush Desai and Minaj Kaja and Raghu Kalori and Mark Meisner. I mean, the list goes on. It's pretty incredible. How did you bring this team together? Was it just a lot of the networking that you guys had done along the way, trying to get feedback even from the early days?
You know, it was interesting. I gave a talk at ICIT, I want to say 2021, maybe 2022, but I was talking about venous stenting, and the venous stents were coming out about a year out, and I'm looking at them and I'm digging into the one-year data really deep. I'm pulling up SSEDs, all of the data that I can in detail, and I'm thinking the outcomes haven't really improved. And I started talking about this, and I gave a talk at ISET specifically sort of saying, hey, like the outcomes we're seeing are not better than when we were off-label using Wallsten's, Protégé's, and things like that. And I started sort of proposing that, hey, I don't know if we've really optimized the biomechanics here. And that talk was not well received. You know, is that people were really excited about the Vita stents, and you know, how could you say this, Ramsey? These are you know, completely different, and they have really high radial force, which is what we wanted. They're incredibly flexible. And when the 3-year data started coming out this past year, and we started seeing all four of the venous stents with the same data, I think the venous community at large, really at these conferences, you could see that the dialogue changed to, well, what are we missing? What is it that we're missing that, you know, we didn't really improve outcomes? Now, the current stents, they're much easier to use. You get distal deployment accuracy that's phenomenal within 1 to 2 millimeters. We're no longer having to cover the contralateral iliac vein ostium, so their durability is fantastic. So there's a lot of improvement when it comes to patient care, fortunately, but what we're not seeing improvement is in the patency. The primary patency of post-thrombotic syndrome is 79% to 81%. And if you look at the pre-2019 FDA approval studies like Dr. Razavi's, and then if you look at each individual one, now 5 companies have done individual studies, and within the PTS group, 80% plus or minus 1%, 79 to 81% every single one. It's remarkable. You don't see this in medicine, that sort of consistency. And so people are really thinking, okay, well, what can we do? And if you look at the coronary artery stenting and any arterial stenting, but particularly coronary artery, the research history there is optimize the biomechanics, and then you can add drug and focus on the physiology. And I think a lot of people are realizing that we have not optimized the biomechanics, that there is room for improvement. And so last year, this is when we really sort of made our push that we're going to try to develop the all-star team. And we went to Dr. Razavi. He quickly joined. We were excited. And then we went out to the community and we said, hey, this is what we're thinking. We're thinking, you know, that everybody is seeing that, you know, we're not getting a lot of improvement, and we want to move things forward, and we think that this is how to do it. And people were excited, and they were excited to join and be part of what's hopefully going to be a project that moves the ball forward for the patients that we're treating. So how did we get the dream team? It's the science, you know, and that's kind of what we're based on, is starting with an observation, understanding the mechanics, and developing technology that's centered around science. And I think that the interventional radiology academic community, that's something they seem to really want to get behind.
Yeah, it really is a star-studded team. And so I want to rewind slightly, though. I wanted to find out a little bit more about, okay, you had talked about you and John and Keshar. The three of you decided we're going to start a company, right? And all three of you are academic at this point, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Had John started a company before?
No, none of us had done it. Keshar was pretty involved with the innovation education courses at OHSU. John obviously had been very involved with multiple companies and sort of advising, but none of us had actually done this where we started the company ourselves. This was our first time.
Tell us about that. I mean, because I know that experience can be stressful, right? Because then you start a company, yeah. You got 2 other co-founders. You're like, okay, how do we divide up the work, right? Who's going to be CEO? Who's going to be this? Who's going to be this? And then also you need to build a team. So can you just kind of walk through the trials and tribulations of that? Because that was in 2019, right?
Yeah, and trials and tribulations is right. It is tough. So we decided I would sort of take the lead and really sort of be the one that's mainly pushing this. And I would say, and this is sort of the second biggest piece of advice I give people when they're starting this, is I just took a lot of meetings, right? I would talk to anybody that would talk to me, whether I thought there would be action out of the meeting or not. And I would just explain where I'm at, explain what I'm doing, and let people react and tell me the mistakes that I'm making and correct and go. And that's kind of how we did it in the beginning, is we were very fortunate to have a lot of people, advisors that were working with us. One of the very first people that I ever talked to was Lindsay McCam. He started off as a strategic advisor. He's on the board now, but I would say as a personal mentor and helping guide me through the process and helping pick me up when I felt like it just couldn't. He has been phenomenal.
There's some lows for sure.
He has been phenomenal. And, you know, I'll never forget one of the first conversation that we had, and he asked me, you know, Ramsey, you don't have to explain it to me, but you need to know why you're doing this and you need to have a good reason. And he said, and it cannot be the money. It absolutely cannot be the money. He said, because if you want money, there's easier ways to make money, like banging your head against the wall at a circus.
Right.
And I think about that all the time, because he's absolutely right. Is, you know, everybody has their personal reason as to why they want to. For me, it is about the underlying concept of taking a scientific observation all the way to a commercial product and feeling that there's a lot of satisfaction in that, but also kind of set an example as this is really how we should be developing technology. And there's a lot of examples of how that's done, and that's done in previous innovation, and that's just kind of important to me. So how we sort of figured it out was really good mentors and good people. OHSU, their business development office in the early stages, they were very, very helpful and really doing a great job of balancing their conflict of they're the university and they have to obviously prioritize the university, but also making sure that the founders understand what they're doing and they're being supported. And I was really appreciative to the whole team there. They did a great job of that. And that's kind of how we did it. And so we went out and we raised our first round of funding in 2021. We also were very fortunate that it's now been 2 years ago that we got our first full-time employee, Abba Chidabai. And Abba has been involved with MedTech device development for 20 years. She was the first engineer on the Vanity stem and incredibly knowledgeable when it comes to MedTech device development. And she's our first full-time employee. And so we were very fortunate to have her join us. That's when we were really able to structure the technological development into a way that is pushing towards commercialization to make sure, you know, you have all the proper testing and everything set up for future manufacturing, thinking about costs, all of the things that I did not have experience in was fantastic. So yeah, we just really, really great advisors all along the way.
Perfect. And so where are you guys now in terms of going to market, FDA process and so forth?
Yeah, so we have performed survival animal testing with very promising results, which shows that we don't get stent-adjacent stenosis like you see with other stents. Inflammation and injury is on par with current stents. So that was sort of the first step to make sure, okay, that this is safe. Where we are currently is we are raising capital to perform our first in-human study outside the U.S. We're going to do 10 to 20 patients outside of the U.S., again, with the goal of showing safety and measuring the adjacent vein and showing that we don't get stent-adjacent stenosis. So we're in the middle of that raise right now, our Series A raise. Once we have that, then it should be about a 18-month timeline to perform that, and then subsequently we'll do the raise to perform an IDE study, a pivotal study for U.S. approval.
For those docs or even, you know, entrepreneurs out there, whether they're in device or not, can you talk about, you know, the money raising process? From what I hear, it can be pretty painful itself, even just learning about it. Like you said, I mean, some of the challenges are just learning about these things.
Yeah, this is a big part of the learning with any startup is how do you get capital? What are the terms that that comes with that you can work with to make sure that you're setting up for the future of the company? And what are the different stages? And that was a big part of the learning for me is that, well, I could present on the technology and how it's needed, but things like understanding the market and the market, you know, the first thing you think about is, okay, well, what's the market size and how many patients are there? How much does a stent cost, a stent procedure? And understanding that is very, very, very important. But then there's a lot of other factors. What's the competition in the market? What's the barriers to entry in the market? How much do you think, you know, your stent, how much improvement are you going to show? And What does that translate in terms of market share? And then that all courses back into your device development, right? Is that, for example, with a venous stent, you can't create a stent that is really difficult to use and doesn't deploy accurately, because the standard right now is that you have easy to use and deploy accurate. So you can't give one thing up and trade off for another. So it all plays into your fundraising, is that there has to be this well thought out story that starts with the problem, your solution, how you're going to get market entry, what the potential earnings are in the future, what the potential exits are. And again, it comes down to the same thing as before. You take a meeting with anybody who will take it. And even if it's a fund that you think particularly this isn't their right stage of development, they're not vascular biotech focused, they're not biotech focused at all, there's a lot of really, really experienced and intelligent people out there that the community is very willing to help you in terms of constructive criticism to say, well, this isn't right for us, but, you know, in terms of your story, I think here's issues that I see. And then you can go back and work on those. And you sort of, it's an iterative process, is getting great people to help you with sort of piecing it together, but then being very open to the feedback that you're getting and saying, okay, well, yeah, that's good feedback. That's something I didn't think about. Let me go and understand that portion a little bit more. So I remember somebody told me early on that, you know, it's easily can be 50 plus pitches just to get a raise. And, you know, I've done several fold that along the way for multiple stages so far. And I think you can view it as a long, painful, time-consuming process, or I think the better way to view it as an iterative improvement process, that each one of these no's can come with some knowledge. And I think that for me, that's kind of what I had to learn from the beginning, is to not get frustrated by the negative feedback and really sort of listen to what people have to say, and understand which ones are useful and how that can really just make us more successful. There, my brother-in-law is deeply involved in the startup world. And along the way, sometimes I've called him at the lows, and he recommended this book called The Messy Middle. And it's a fantastic book. Really recommend it. And the crux of it is that the startup world is not an A to B path. And you might think that you're coming in and you understand it and you're going to go from A to B, but you're going from A to Z, and there's 24 letters in the middle that are going to put you all in these curves that you absolutely cannot predict. And you have to understand that that's part of the process, and you have to be able to move with it. The story that people get in stories just like this, and you know, all innovation stories, is how did it start and how did it end? And those are the exciting things that people want to talk about, and they don't talk about the messy middle. But that is where I think a lot of success comes from, is people understanding and willing to roll with those punches and to go with it and to work with the community. And, you know, you mentioned Osmond before. You know, we've sort of talked, and there's a community out there who's all sort of pushing and struggling through the same issues, and you work together and you support each other. And but I think that's a big part of people wanting to get into this, is you have to understand the path is nebulous. You might know the beginning, you may or may not know the end, but you definitely don't know the messy middle, and you have to be willing to go through that process.
It's so true. And I think that's some of the best advice, is the endurance and the persistence through that messy middle. Because even, I mean, something as simple as, you know, our podcast network, there's a lot of messiness. It's a media company at the end of the day. And there's a lot of times where it, you know, we haven't even had to do a financial raise, but like just in terms of team building and the negative feedback you can get sometimes, again, how do you use that to iterate and make it better, right? And continue to evolve. I sometimes forget, and this is some of the advice I've gotten, is that, look, if there's an end, hopefully it's a happy ending, but it's not going to be the beginning or the ending that you're going to look back on. It's going to be the whole path, right? It's going to be the whole experience along the way that really you actually grew from and that you gained knowledge from. It's not the beginning or the end. I can't wait to read that book, because that's sort of I'm seeking out information about that right now because we're always like changing things up and trying to see what works and what doesn't. And it's a painful process, you know? So I think that's great advice.
Yeah. The highs are high and the lows are low.
Yeah,
and
the lows are low.
There's one thing you got to do is you stay in the middle. You don't ride them. You just know that this is a problem we're going to get through. And again, I know I've said it many times, but there is a phenomenal innovation community out there who is just very supportive and just everybody wants everybody to succeed, you know, because everybody knows there's already enough challenges out there that you absolutely have to support each other in any way that you can. So I would say if somebody is, you know, thinking that they want to get started in this, looking back, you know, this was something that John Kaufman did really well and, you know, probably was the key to getting us anywhere lifted off is getting in touch with that community and getting people who will talk to you and mentor you and help just with the big guidance along the way. And you'd be surprised how many people are willing to take their personal time to meet with you and help you. And all I want to do is pay it forward, you know, because there have been so many people that have helped me along the way. And I think that's how a lot of people feel is it's a pay it forward community.
I think, and that's the common denominator of all the guests we've had on the show. It's very similar. And, you know, and I keep in touch with a lot of people after the fact because, you know, you're like, hey, man, I'm struggling through this right now. Like, have you experienced this, right? And, you know, I'm looking for this sort of team member. What's your advice on that? And you're right. Whether it's med device or media or, you know, medical education, it is a very friendly and collaborative community. So the other thing that you mentioned, which you kind of flew past, was the fact that you've done hundreds of pitches, which is hours of your time, not just the pitch itself, but preparation and so forth. That is a whole different level of endurance. That's like triathlon type endurance, right? To like push forward through all of that. And I think about that because nobody has any idea how much time people are putting in literally blood, sweat, and tears into their startups. And it's I always laugh that it's my third child because it's like you put as much time into the startup as one of your kids pretty much, you know? And you mentioned this in the beginning when we were chatting is you work on this startup, but you're also in practice. Are you full-time practice?
I am full-time practice. It was one of the reasons that I moved to private practice when this started is I recognized that outside of direct patient care, a lot of my time was going to be towards this. And I didn't want to, dividing it between education, practice building in an academic setting, and this, I didn't think it was fair, honestly. I was just going to be way too diluted. And I kind of have a pretty strong feeling that if you're in academics, you should be really focusing on training him. And so I thought, you know, the right thing to do is go into private practice for some time so I can do direct patient care. And then when I'm not doing that, then I could do this. And so fortunately, I'm in a position now that does give me in private practice a good bit of personal time. So I have a lot of time to focus on this. It is very time consuming. You're right. There's a lot behind the scenes that people don't understand. When I started, I had one or two whites on the side here. Now you can see it's basically struggling to find any black hairs. And, you know, but it's, I think personally, my wife, my family, we kind of all committed that, okay, we're going to do this. And again, fortunately, you know, we had some friends that were involved in the space. So my wife sort of understood that it was going to be a big commitment from the beginning. So it wasn't a surprise. And it's been a team effort for the family, right? As you know, I'm definitely busy between my practice working on this and my two kids who are 1.5 and 4. And I definitely make sure that I want to spend time with them through this, but it's a team effort with the family to do all of this. But I will say the big help has been in private practice, having a little bit more time and, you know, a little bit more separation between, okay, when I'm at the hospital working on patient care, and then when I'm, you know, at home and I'm not with the family, then I can work on this. So it's a little bit easier in my mind to separate the two versus academics, where at least for me, a lot of times when I was at home, I was still involved a good bit, whether it was helping colleagues or following up on things or writing papers and making presentations, those types of things. So it's tough. It's time consuming, but fortunately, I've been really lucky to make it work.
Do you guys have a headquarters in San Diego, or is it still kind of remote? Everybody's a little bit remote.
We're still virtual. Our main headquarters is a manufacturing facility, Resonetics, and they've been fantastic. And we were really lucky because right when I moved to San Diego, their main facilities have been on the East Coast, and they just opened one up here. There's a growing biotech in Sorrento Valley and San Diego, and they just opened up a facility. And we were really lucky because it's 10 minutes from my house, and they have availability, and they have a lightning lab, which is fantastic to do your prototyping and early testing, and then they can roll straight into manufacturing in that facility. So we've been really lucky. And then we still do animal testing, actually. We've been doing it at Daughter. So I've been going up there for the animal testing. So we're still mostly virtual, but very lucky to have good facilities to work at.
Awesome. Well, Ramsey, we're coming up on the hour. Anything that I left behind, anything, any final thoughts for the audience?
You know, when people ask me about it, the main thing I like to really emphasize is kind of what we talked about, is that it's an exciting world. It's a great community. I encourage people to do it. And I think that it's really fun. And, you know, the ultimate goal is that while being a physician is very rewarding, the one-on-one patients that you can help, is that the ultimate goal is all the sacrifice, is that we're going to create a device that's going to help thousands and thousands of patients is our ultimate goal. And, you know, as tough as it can be, that really is a unique and small ultimate community that it's really a privilege to be a part of. So I encourage people to do it. And I just also encourage them to get good mentors early on and understand what you're going to be going through and make sure you have people to support you through it, because it can definitely be tough.
And last question, actually, I didn't think about before, but I'm sure you have a roadmap since you're out there trying to raise money. But for the docs out there who are looking forward to getting this in their hands, is there an expected year that where we might see it come to market if all goes smoothly?
Yeah, if all goes smoothly, it's a year and a half for the first in human. And then the pivotal trial, it's a year. But then, you know, you have a year of enrollment and then the follow-up FDA approval. So it's about 4.5 to 5 years from now. So still a little bit of patience, but we will get there is our plan.
Yeah, fantastic. And also ISETs this week. Are you going to ISET?
Not this year, unfortunately not. Yeah, I'll be at SIR, but not ISET this year. And then I'll be at Charing Cross as well. We'll be talking about auxitics there.
Awesome. Well, hopefully I'll see you at SIR in March then. We'll have to grab a drink.
Perfect. Look forward to it. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Ramsey.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Anne Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jimmy Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.